Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Lako Tongan, who is a professor of international and intercultural studies and political science at Pitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, where he witnessed its Independence Day firsthand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lako Tongan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And you, of course, were there for the declaration of statehood for the Republic of South Sudan on July the 9th. And prior to that and subsequent to that, of course, have been tensions on the border in the disputed area of Abyei, which the UN sent in peacekeepers from Ethiopia, 4,200 strong. And now there have been four of them killed. So this doesn't bode well.
That is true. First of all, let me say that the occasion that the witness of independence, the declaration of independence of South Sudan, was an event, basically, that vindicated many of us who have been fighting for that day to come. And so we have a new country, we have a new nation, and certainly there are problems that this nation is going to confront, especially
Obama for who he was. I would have voted for Cynthia McKinney. I would have appreciated her being on the scene.
What happened there? Do we still have Lako?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Go ahead. Somebody must have picked up the phone.
Right, that's right.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So the challenges are many, but one of those, of course, is what is happening along the border. And the border area is not only Abyei, but now there is what they call South Kordofan, a region which is occupied by the Nubers. And so in Abyei, this is particularly an area which is at the heart, in fact, of Southern belief that it belongs to the South. And it has a long history as to how it reached this particular status. This goes back to 1905, actually, when the Dinka Nok, especially the chief of the Dinka Nok, decided that they were going to be a part of the North. So when the wars went on, I mean, the First Civil War, the Second Civil War, the end of the Second Civil War, of course, is the added, what they call the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And in that peace agreement, there is a protocol that allows actually Abyei to vote on whether they want to continue to be a part of the North or to be a part of the South. That was supposed to take place simultaneously when the South was having its referendum on January 9th to the 15th. Now, the Khartoum government, of course, has not allowed that referendum to take place in Abyei. And so that is one of the source of the problems and, in fact, the tension that is right now for conflict over that region. Now, one thing that is clear, of course, is that a good number of leaders, actually, who are leading the SPLM, SPLA, that is the Sudan Liberation Movement in the South and Sudan Liberation Army, come from this region, Abyei. For example, the foreign minister of this new country of South Sudan is from Abyei. And so there is enough support for the Abyei people, basically, to carry out that referendum. They are demanding that the referendum should be fulfilled as it was signed on.
Now, did the 100,000 people who fled Abyei and fled to South Sudan, will they go back to vote?
If they allow that the vote to take place, yes, they will go back, actually, because also the UN is involved in that process. Now, part of the problem about the UN role is that since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement has come to an end as a result of the independence of South Sudan, the Khartoum government is requesting that they leave that region, that is the border region. And I think that is likely to happen. That is why the UN decided that they should send in Ethiopian troops, Ethiopian soldiers. And as you mentioned correctly, there are 4,200 Ethiopian troops. And just recently, again, as you have correctly noted, four killed and seven injured by landmines in Abyei. And so that is, again, sending, I think, a wrong message, actually, as to what might happen to the UN troops who are largely Ethiopians in that region.
Well, it's almost impossible not to blame the North for that, for at least for planting the landmines. Surely they occupied that town, did they not?
They did. In May, they occupied Abyei. They occupied it, and the United Nations Security Council voted, of course, condemning the occupation. And the UN also demanded that they should withdraw. So the condition for withdrawal was to say we want a force, actually, that will replace them and perhaps be able to protect the citizens or the civilians in Abyei. I think the Ethiopian force has been authorized to use force in order to protect civilians in Abyei.
Again, I'm speaking with Lako Tongan, who was born and raised in South Sudan and is now, which has only recently become a country, and he's a professor at Pitzer College. And you've been active in the liberation movement for South Sudan. This has been a 21-year-long struggle against the North, and you were close to the very charismatic leader, John Garang, who waged this guerrilla war against the North, who, you know, again, as I mentioned in the opening, the leader of the North has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for genocide, General Omar Bashir. There's been many, many stories, of course, and documented evidence of widespread genocide by the North in Darfur and in the area that they're bombing, where the Nuba live, just recently. But tell us a bit about John Garang, because it was his skill as a guerrilla fighter that finally wore the North down, and they had to make this deal under international pressure. They certainly didn't want to make this deal because they're giving up the fertile and oil-rich part of their country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. John Garang was a colleague. John Garang, we were refugees together in Uganda in a camp called Bombo, which incidentally, after witnessing the independence, I went to Uganda and went to the refugee camp, which is now actually, that camp is now a military barracks for the Ugandan army. But John Garang, we were together here in the United States before he went and joined the guerrilla movement of the First Civil War. That was the First Civil War from 1955 to 1972. It was towards the end of that war that John Garang, actually, after he finished his college at Grinnell College, decided to go and join the guerrilla force. It was called Anyanya. Now, John Garang, I think, was able to develop new ideas about how to view the problem of South Sudan. Let me put it that way, the problem of South Sudan. That is how the North, actually, Northern elites were looking at the problem, that it was a problem of Southern Sudan, sometimes referred to as the Southern problem. John Garang reversed that argument and said, it is a problem of the Sudan as a whole. That is why he formed the Sudan People's Liberation Army, Sudan People's Liberation Movement, to distinguish it from Southern Sudan Liberation Movement, which was the the one during the First Civil War. So that argument, I think, changed the character of the Sudanese conflict in the sense that it was able now to include Africans who are in the North. Remember, when we talk about Northern Sudan, we tend to lump together those who identify themselves as Arabs and those who are Africans. So by addressing it as a Sudan problem, he basically framed it as a problem between those who are marginalized, namely those who are in what is referred to now as African peripheries, okay, distinguishing them from those who are along the River Nile in the north who claim themselves to be Arabs. That argument was able to win a vast number of northern Sudanese who are Africans. The Nubers, the Darfuris, in fact, started their conflict because of what John Gerang was arguing. That, in fact, if you look at the Sudan, it is the problem of the Africans who are marginalized versus the Arabs who have been controlling, the Arab elites who have been controlling the government, all the powers of the state since the country became independent in 1956. Mm-hmm. That argument is what made it very difficult for the Khartoum elites, basically.
Well, let me just in the last couple of minutes, get to the present situation, because clearly the Khartoum government had to agree to this deal, which reluctantly. The oil's in the south, the pipelines are in the north. The Khartoum regime's mismanagement, cronyism, and profligate military spending has basically bankrupted them. Mm-hmm. So this is a dangerous government because it's its own people. You know, there's a thing going on around that neighborhood called the Arab Spring, right?
That's right.
So what do you think is going to happen?
The regime is going to have a tough time. Again, you know, mentioning the issue of the Nuba Mountains.
Right. Well, we've only got about 20 seconds. Sorry.
Okay, right. That regime is going to face now conflicts within the north itself. Darfuris, the Nubas, southern Blue Nile people, and eastern Sudan, they are working together now to form an alliance, basically to fight Khartoum.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. Lako Tongan, again, Professor of International Intercultural Studies and Political Studies at Peitzer College. He was born and raised in what is the world's newest country, South Sudan, where he witnessed its Independence Day firsthand. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? Well, we went down to New Orleans to speak with Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She, a blueprint of ALEKS, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is this corporate manufactured front group that's coordinating all this corporate-friendly legislation in all 50 state houses and in the Capitol. She got a blueprint of ALEKS' legislative onslaught of 800 bills, which was leaked to her. So she's down there where their annual conference underway of all these corporate whores gathering in prostitution-friendly New Orleans, the Big Easy. And she was explaining to us how, first of all, it's amazing that this group can exist. It's a non-profit, even though it's received something like $400 million from corporate America, and it's, you know, under the nonprofit rules, you can only educate, you can't advocate, and here they are passing legislation, crafting legislation, getting it through, and taking care of the congressmen or the legislators who get it through. This is the corporatization of American politics in its most naked form. We've already seen the corporatization of the Supreme Court, and this is its ugly twin. It's quite a story. And then we talk with David Ruscio, professor of economics at Notre Dame, about what looks like a kind of gathering perfect storm of an economic calamity. These prominent Wall Streeters have been predicting a double dip recession and cascading municipal bonds, and the bond markets are being slammed in Spain and Italy. So he was able to really put it all together and of course the analogy is with what happened with Smoot Hawley, which was a know-nothing ignoramuses, just like these Tea Party people who dug the hole deeper during the Depression by passing legislation that was based upon economic ignorance. And we made that analogy with what's happening today in the United States Congress, of course, and the difference is that in this case, Obama owns it as much as the Republicans, who claim they got 98% of what they wanted, since they passed it together. They're joined at the hip. And the third segment was with Larko Tongan, who's just back from southern Sudan, his native southern Sudan. He was very close to the guerrilla leader who founded the country but was mysteriously killed just as the north finally capitulated after 21 years of guerrilla war. Already in this new country, only formed on July the 9th, is having a kind of guerrilla war on its northern border. Ethiopian peacekeepers were just killed, and it does look pretty grim. But he's basically, at the end of the day, thinks it's the northern, the Arab north is the one that's going to collapse through corruption and cronyism and enormous waste of military spending. And it's really a war between black Africans and Arabs. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.